scarf and top hat to match. His eyes were obscured by dark glasses, and his lip obscured by a thick brown mustache. "Hello, Willie," he said. "I have a message for your father. I would very much like you to give it to him." Now it was Tad's screams that brought the guards running. The vampires were the first to arrive, with Layman and several soldiers on their heels. I came bounding down the steps of the south portico next, and found Tad frightened and crying, but seemingly unharmed. Willie, however, was rubbing his tongue with his coat sleeve and spitting repeatedly. I took him in my arms and looked him over, turning his face and neck this way, that way, all the while praying there were no wounds on his body. "There," Layman cried, pointing to a figure running south. "He and the Trinity gave chase, while the others hastened us into the house. Alive," I cried after them, "alive." Layman and the Trinity chased the figure across Pennsylvania Avenue and through the Ellipse. Footnote: a circular 52-acre park often used as campgrounds for Union troops. When it became clear that he couldn't keep pace, the breathless Layman drew his revolver and, with no regard for the innocent bystanders he might have hit, fired at the distant figure until his cartridges were spent. The Trinity was gaining on its target. The four vampires ran south toward the unfinished Washington Monument, into the field of grazing cattle that surrounded it. Construction of the massive marble obelisk, at 150 feet, it was only one-third its eventual height, had been halted, and a temporary slaughterhouse erected in its shadow to help meet the needs of a hungry army. It was into this long wooden building that the stranger now disappeared, desperate to lose the killers who were only 50 yards behind him. Perhaps there would be knives to fight with inside, blood to throw them off his scent, anything. But there were no carcasses in the slaughterhouse that Sunday afternoon. No workers cutting the throats of cattle. Only dozens of metal hooks hanging from rafters overhead, each reflecting the late-day sun that squeezed through the open doors at both ends of the long building. The stranger ran across the blood-stained wooden floor, looking for a place to hide, a weapon to wield. He found neither. "The river. I can lose them in the river." He sprinted toward an open door at the far end, determined to head south to the Potomac. Once there, he would dive beneath its surface and slip away. But his exit was blocked by the silhouette of a man. "The other door." The stranger stopped and turned back. There were two more silhouettes behind him. There would be no escape. He stood near the center of the long building as his pursuers advanced from either end, slowly, cautiously. They meant to capture him, torture him, demand to know who'd sent him and what he'd done to the boy. And if captured, chances were that he would tell them everything. This he could not allow. The stranger smiled as his pursuers neared. "Know this," he said, "that you are the slaves of slaves." He took a breath, closed his eyes, and leapt onto one of the hanging hooks, stabbing himself through the heart. I like to think that in his final moments, as his body convulsed and blood poured from his nose and mouth, joining that of the animals below, that he saw the flames of hell beneath his feet and felt the first of an eternity's agony. I like to think that he was afraid. As guards sealed the White House and searched the grounds, Willie sat in his father's office, calmly relating, while a doctor looked him over, what had happened. "The stranger had grabbed his face," he said, "pried his mouth open and poured something bitter into it. My thoughts turned at once to my mother's death from a fool's dose of vampire blood, and I fell into silent despair at the thought of seeing my beloved little boy suffer her fate. The doctor found no signs of injury or symptoms of poisoning, but made Willie swallow several spoonfuls of powdered charcoal as a precaution, an experience he found far worse than the assault itself." Footnote: activated charcoal has long been used as a treatment for poisoning. It works by absorbing toxins in the intestines before they can reach the bloodstream. That night, as Mary tended to Tad, who had been quite shaken by the day's events, I sat by Willie's bedside, watching him sleep, watching him for the slightest sign of sickness. To my great relief, he seemed well the next morning, and I began to entertain the faint hope that it had all been nothing more than a scare. But as Monday morning wore on, Willie grew increasingly tired and sore, and by the second night, he was running a fever. All business ground to a halt as Willie grew worse, and the best doctors in Washington were summoned to treat him. They did all they could to treat his symptoms, but could find no cure for them. For 3 days and nights, Mary and I kept a vigil at his bedside, praying for his recovery, fervent in our belief that youth and providence would see him through. I read him passages from his favorite books as he slept, ran my fingers through his soft brown hair, and wiped the sweat from his brow. On the fourth day, our prayers seemed answered. Willie began to mend on his own, and my faint hopes returned. It could not be a fool's dose, I told myself, for he would surely be dead by now. But after a few hours' reprieve, Willie's health began to worsen again. He couldn't eat or drink without being sick to his stomach. His body withered and weakened, and his fever refused to subside. On the ninth day, he could not be roused from sleep. And on the tenth, despite the best efforts of the best physicians available, it became clear that Willie was going to die. Mary could not bring herself to hold another of our little boys as he left this earth. It fell to me to cradle our sleeping son against my chest and gently rock him through the night, through the next morning, and through the day that followed. I refused to let him go. Refused to let go of that faintest hope that God would not be so cruel. On Thursday, February 20th, 1862, at 5 p.m., Willie Lincoln died in his father's arms. Elizabeth Keckley was a freed slave who worked mainly as Mary Lincoln's dressmaker. Years later, she recalled the sight of Lincoln weeping openly, his tall frame convulsing with emotion. "Genius and greatness," she said, weeping over love's idol lost. John Nicolay remembered the tough, towering president walking to his office door, as if in some trance. "Well, Nicolay," he said, staring off into space, "my boy is gone. He is actually gone." Abe barely made it into his office before bursting into tears. For the next 4 days, Abe conducted little government business. He did, however, fill nearly 24 pages in his journal, some of them with lamentations. "Willie will never know the tender touch of a woman, or experience those particular joys of a first love. He will never know the complete peace of holding his own tiny son in his arms. He will never read the great works of literature or see the great cities of the world. He will never see another sunrise or feel another drop of rain against his sweet face." Others with thoughts of suicide. "I have come to believe that the only peace in this life is the end of it. Let me wake at last from this nightmare, this brief, meaningless nightmare of loss and struggle, of endless sacrifice. All that I love waits on the other side of death. Let me find the courage to open my eyes at last." And sometimes, with blind rage, "I wish to see the face of the cowardly God who delights in these miseries, who delights in striking down children." in stealing innocent sons from their mothers and fathers. Oh, let me see his face and rip out his black heart. Let me strike him down as I have so many of his demons. Arrangements were made to transport Willie's body to Springfield, where it would be buried near the Lincolns' permanent home. But Abe couldn't bear the idea of having his little boy so far away, and at the last minute, it was decided that Willie would lie in a Washington crypt until the end of his father's presidency. 2 days after the funeral, which Mary, overcome with grief, could not attend, Abe returned to the crypt and ordered his son's casket opened. I sat beside him, as I had on so many nights during his brief life, half expecting him to wake and embrace me, for such was the skill of his embalmer that he seemed merely asleep. I stayed with him an hour or more, speaking to him tenderly, laughing as I told him stories of his earliest mischief, his first steps, his peculiar laugh, telling him how very loved he would always be. When our time was through, and the lid again affixed to his coffin, I began to weep. I could not bear the thought of his being alone in that cold, dark box, alone where I could not comfort him. With Mary confined to bed, Abe sought refuge behind his closed office door in the week after Willie's death. Fearing for his health, Nicolay and Hay canceled all of his meetings indefinitely, and laymen in the Trinity guarded his door at all hours. Dozens of well-wishers came to offer the president their sympathies that week. All were thanked and politely turned away, until the night of February 28th, when one man was ushered directly into his office. He'd given the name that could never be refused. 4. I cannot imagine the burden you bear, said Henry. The weight of a nation on your shoulders, of a war, and now the weight of another son buried. Abe sat in the light of the fireplace, his old axe hanging above its mantle. Is this why you come, Henry? To remind me of my miseries? If that be the case, then I assure you, I am too aware of them already. I come to offer my sympathies to an old friend, and to offer you a choice. No, Abe choked up at once. I will not hear it. I will not be tormented with this again. It is not my wish to torment. Then what is it, Henry? Tell me, what is your wish? To see me suffer? To see the tears run freely down my cheeks? Here, does this face satisfy you? Abraham. Abe rose from his chair. The whole of my life has been spent on your errands, Henry. The whole of my life. And to what end? To what happiness of my own? All that I have ever loved has fallen prey to your kind. I have given you everything. What have you given me in return? I have given you my everlasting loyalty, my protection from the... Death, said Abe. You have given me death. Abe looked at the axe over his mantle. All that I have ever loved. Abraham, do not give in to this despair. Remember your mother. Remember what she whispered with her dying breath. Do not try to manipulate me, Henry, and do not pretend to care that I suffer. You care only for your own gains, for your war. You know nothing of loss. Now Henry rose to his feet. I have spent these 300 years mourning a wife and child, Abraham. Mourning the life that was stolen from me. 1,000 loves lost to time. You know nothing of the lengths I have gone to protect you. Nothing of that which I have suffered. Henry composed himself. No, he said. No, it mustn't be this way. We have come too far for this. He grabbed his coat and hat. You have my respects, and you have my offer. If you choose to leave Willie buried, so be it. The sound of Willie's name roused such wildness in me, Henry's callous tone, such rage that I grabbed the axe from its perch and swung at his head with a scream, missing him by less than an inch and shattering the clock on the mantel. I recovered and swung again, but Henry leapt over my blade. The office door now flew open behind us, and two of the Trinity rushed in. On seeing us, they froze, unsure of where their loyalties lay. Layman, however, was plagued by no such uncertainty. On entering, he drew his revolver and aimed it at Henry, only to have it taken by one of the vampires before he could fire. Henry stood in the center of the room, arms at his sides. I charged again, raising my axe as I ran. Henry didn't so much as blink as I came. Rather, he grabbed the handle as I brought it down on his head, took it from me, and snapped it in two, throwing the pieces on the floor. I came at him with my fists, but these he caught as well, twisting them around and forcing me to my knees. Holding me thus, he knelt behind me and brought his fangs to my neck. "No!" cried Layman, rushing forward. The others held him back. I felt the tips of those twin razors against my flesh. "Do it!" I cried. "The only peace in this life is the end of it." "Do it! I beg you!" I felt the tiny trickles of blood run down my neck as his fangs broke through my skin. I closed my eyes and prepared to meet the unknown, to see my beloved boys once more. But it was not to be. Henry withdrew his fangs and let me go. "Some people are just too interesting to kill, Abraham," he said, rising to his feet. He gathered his coat and hat again and walked to the door, toward the three anxious guards whose hearts were racing faster than my own. "Henry?" He turned back. "I will see this war to its end, but I do not care to see another vampire so long as I live." Henry offered a slight bow. "Mr. President." With that, he disappeared. Abe wouldn't see him for the rest of his life. 12. Starve the Devils. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue, until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Abraham Lincoln's Second Inaugural Address, March 4, 1865. 1. Washington, D.C. was under attack, and Abe wasn't about to miss his chance to see the fighting up close. On July 11, 1864, ignoring the pleas of his personal guard, he rode alone on horseback to Fort Stevens. Footnote: the Battle of Fort Stevens marks the only occasion in American history a sitting president was under fire in combat, where Confederate General Jubal A. Early was leading 17,000 rebels in a brazen assault on Washington's northern defenses. The president was greeted by Union officers and whisked directly into the fort, where he would be able to relax and enjoy a cool drink behind the safety of its thick stone walls. "I hadn't come to be coddled or hear the battle described to me. I'd come to see the horrors of war for myself, to see what others had suffered these 3 long years, while I had remained behind the walls of warmth and plenty. Try as they might, the officers couldn't discourage me from peeking over the parapet to watch boys line up and ceremoniously shoot one another, to see them blown apart by cannon fire and run through by bayonets." The sight of Abraham Lincoln towering over the battlefield in his stovepipe hat must have seemed a godsend for the rebel sharpshooters at Fort Stevens that day. Abe had 3 bullets zip past him in as many minutes, each one giving his minders terrible fits of anxiety. Finally, when a Union officer standing next to him was struck in the head and killed, the president felt a tug at the bottom of his coat and heard First Lieutenant and future Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes yell, "Get down, you damned fool!" But he didn't. He'd completely lost his fear of death. There were no more vampires at the White House. Abe had banished them in the wake of Willie's death and his confrontation with Henry. Even the Trinity, his most capable and ferocious protectors, had been sent back to New York. "I shall save this Union because it merits saving. I shall save it to honor the men who built it with their blood and genius, and the future generations who deserve its liberty. I shall give every miserable hour to the cause of victory and peace, but I shall be damned if I lay eyes on another vampire." The First Family was now guarded exclusively by living men, and the president guarded less and less at his own insistence. Each day brought new restrictions on his guards. Each day fewer rooms he welcomed them in. Over Ward Hill Lehman's objections, Abe insisted on riding out in an open carriage when the weather was agreeable, and on walking between the mansion and the War Department alone after dark. As Lehman recalled in his memoirs years later, "I believe that it was more than an absence of fear. I believe that it was an invitation of death." A journal entry from April 20, 1862, sums up Abe's growing fatalism. "In the course of a week, I greet 1,000 strange faces in the White House. Should I treat each as the face of my assassin? Indeed, any man willing to give his life to take mine would have little trouble doing it. Am I therefore to lock myself in an iron box and wait for this war to end? If God wants my soul, he knows where he may collect it, and he may do so at the hour and in the manner of his choosing." In time, through sheer force of will, he would pull himself out of this depression, just as he had all the ones before it. Not long after Willie's death, when his longtime friend William McCullough was killed fighting for the Union, Abe sent a letter to the grieving daughter McCullough had left behind. The comfort and advice he offered was meant as much for himself as for the girl. "Perfect relief is not possible except with time. You cannot now realize that you will ever feel better. Is not this so? And yet, it is a mistake. You are sure to be happy again. To know this, which is certainly true, will make you some less miserable now. I have had experience enough to know what I say, and you need only to believe it to feel better at once. The memory of your dear father, instead of an agony, will be a sad, sweet feeling in your heart, of a purer and holier sort than you have known before." But while Abe was picking himself up and soldiering on, Mary was only getting worse. "She cannot bring herself to leave her bed for more than an hour's time, nor can she attend to Tad, who grieves not only for a brother, but a mother as well. I am ashamed to admit that there are moments when the very sight of her angers me. Ashamed because it is no fault of hers that she suffers fits of rage, or believes the charlatans who commune with our beloved sons for money. She has borne more than any mother ought to bear. I fear that her mind is gone, and that it shall never return." 2. Though Abe refused to have any direct contact with Henry or the Union, he was pragmatic enough to accept their help in winning the war. In New York, the Grand Ballroom, where Abe first learned of the Union and its plans for him, had been transformed into a war room, complete with maps, chalkboards, and a telegraph. They acted as envoys to the sympathetic vampires of Europe. They fought where they were able, and supplemented the White House's intelligence with that collected by their own spies. This intelligence was delivered to Seward, who, after reading and burning the messages, related their contents to the president. From an entry dated June 10, 1862. "Today comes word that the Confederates are handing Union prisoners over to Southern vampires for the purpose of torture and execution. We hear of men," said Seward, "hung upside down and stretched between posts, Using a logger's saw, two vampires slowly cut the prisoner in half, beginning at his groin. As they do, a third vampire lies on his back beneath the poor wretch, catching the blood that runs down his body. Because the prisoner's head is nearest the ground, his brain remains nourished, and he remains conscious until the blade tears slowly back and forth through his stomach, then chest. The other prisoners are made to watch this before being made to suffer it themselves. Rumors of Confederate ghosts and demons snatching men from their tents and drinking their blood spread through the Union ranks during the war's second summer. Soldiers could be heard singing a popular song around their campfires at night. From Florida to Virginia, you can hear 'em revel, for old Johnny Rebs made a deal with the devil. Sent him up north, that snake-eyed liar, to drag us boys off to the lake of fire. In at least one case, these rumors led a group of Union soldiers to turn on one of their own. On July 5, 1862, Private Morgan Sloss was murdered by five of his fellow soldiers while in camp near Berkeley Plantation in Virginia. They pulled him from his tent in the dead of night and beat him, all the while accusing him of being a blood-drinking demon. Had the boy actually been a vampire, he would have made a better show of defending himself. They tied him to a hitching post and set on him with sticks and shovels, demanding he confess. "Tell us you're a blood-drinking demon and we'll let you go," they cried, all the while thrashing him till he wept and begged for mercy. After a quarter of an hour of this, the mumbled confession at last came from his bloodied lips. I suspect the boy would have confessed to being Christ himself if it had meant an end to his agony. His confession noted he was then doused in lamp oil and burned alive. The fear he must have felt, the confusion and the fear. I cannot think of it without my fists clenching in anger. If only by some miracle of time and heaven I could have been there to intervene. Abe found the incident deeply troubling, not only for its cruelty, but because it meant that the Confederate strategy was working. How can we hope to win this war when our men have begun killing each other? How can we hope to prevail when they will soon be too frightened to fight? For every vampire sympathetic to our cause, there are 10 fighting for the enemy. How am I to contest them? As it often did for Abe, the answer came in a dream. From an entry dated July 21, 1862. I was a boy again, sitting atop a familiar fence rail in the cool of a cloudy day, watching travelers pass on the old Cumberland Trail. I remember seeing a horse cart filled with Negroes, each of them shackled at the wrist, without so much as a handful of loose hay to comfort the bumps of the road, or a blanket to relieve them from the winter air. My eyes met those of the youngest, a Negro girl of perhaps 5 or 6, as they passed. I wanted to turn away, such was the sorrow of her countenance, yet I could not, for I knew where she was being taken. Night had fallen. I had followed the Negro girl, I know not how, to a large barn, the inside lit by torches and hanging oil lamps. I watched from the darkness as she and the others were made to stand in a line, their eyes firmly fixed on the ground. I watched as a vampire took its place behind each of the slaves. Her eyes found mine as a pair of fangs descended behind her, and a pair of clawed hands grabbed her tiny neck. "Justice," she said, staring at me. The fangs tore into her. Her screams joined my own as I woke. Abe convened his cabinet the next morning. "Gentlemen," I began, "we have spoken a great deal about the true nature of this war, about our true enemy. We have argued, always in the spirit of friendship, over the wisest way to meet such an enemy, and bemoaned his power to strike fear into the hearts of our men. I dare say that we have even come to share in that fear ourselves. This will not do. Gentlemen, let our enemy fear us. Let us deny him the laborers who tend the farms of his living allies, who build his garrisons and carry his gunpowder. Let us deny him the poor wretches who are themselves grown as crops to be consumed by darkness. Now, gentlemen, let us starve the devils into defeat by declaring every slave in the South free. Cheers went up around the table. Even Sam and Chase, who still refused to believe that vampires were real, saw the strategic genius of attacking the engine of the South. Seward, while joining the others in his approval, offered a piece of humble advice. He suggested that such a proclamation be given to the country on the heels of a victory, so as not to appear an act of desperation. "Well," I said, "then I suppose we need a victory." 3. On September 17, 1862, the Union and Confederate armies collided at Antietam Creek near the town of Sharpsburg, Maryland. The Confederate forces were commanded by General Robert E. Lee, who'd enjoyed a warm relationship with the president before the war. The Union forces were commanded by General George B. McClellan, a Democrat who despised Abraham Lincoln with every fiber of his being. Abe writes, "McClellan thinks me a buffoon, unfit to command a man of his superior breeding and intellect. This would not bother me in the least if only he won more battles. Instead, he sits in his camp, using the Army of the Potomac as his personal bodyguard. He suffers from an excess of caution, observing when he should attack, retreating when he should stand his ground and fight. This is a sin that I cannot forgive in a general." Lee and McClellan's armies waited quietly in the pre-dawn hours of that Wednesday, September 17th, unaware that they were about to embark on the bloodiest day in American military history. At first light, both sides unleashed their artillery. For nearly an hour, the shells flew one after the other, many with fuses timed to make them explode over their targets, sending burning pieces of shrapnel through the bodies of any soldier unfortunate enough to be nearby. From the diary of Union soldier Christoph Niederer, 20th New York Infantry, 6th Corps. Footnote: Civil War Miscellaneous Collection, USA MHI. I had just got myself pretty comfortable when a bomb burst over me and completely deafened me. I felt a blow on my right shoulder and my jacket, and was covered with white stuff. I felt mechanically whether I still had my arm, and thank God it was still whole. At the same time, I felt something damp on my face. I wiped it off. It was bloody. Now I first saw that the man next to me, Kessler, lacked the upper part of his head, and almost all his brains had gone into the face of the man next to him, Merkel, so that he could scarcely see. Since any moment the same could happen to anyone, no one thought much about it. When the cannons fell quiet, Union troops were given orders to fix bayonets and charge across an open cornfield toward the entrenched Confederates. But an artillery battery was waiting for them in the tall stalks, and when they neared, the rebel cannons unleashed round after round of grape shot, taking heads off and scattering body parts across the field. Footnote: Grape shot is a type of cannon ammunition similar to a shotgun shell. Small metal balls are packed tightly together in a projectile. When fired, the balls spread out to cause a greater damage. Grape shot was packed into canisters and used for close-range engagement. From a letter by Lieutenant Sebastian Duncan, Jr., 13th New Jersey Infantry, 12th Corps. Footnote: Duncan Papers, New Jersey Historical Society. "Stray shot and shell began to whiz over our heads and burst around us. Lying just in front of our lines was a great number of dead and wounded. One poor fellow lay just before us with one leg shot off, the other shattered and otherwise badly wounded, fairly shrieking with pain." When the charge was over, the cornfield was a bare, smoldering ruin, covered with the dead and the dying from one end to the other. The wounded were left to suffer alone as shells continued to fall, taking fresh limbs and scattering the ones that had been taken already. The battle was barely 2 hours old. More than 6,000 men would lose their lives at Antietam that day, and another 20,000 would be wounded, many of them mortally. Lee would eventually be forced into retreat, but after using only 2/3 of his available forces to fight the battle, a fact that continues to baffle military historians, General George B. McClellan simply watched as the battered Confederate army limped into Virginia to regroup. Had he chased them down, he could have dealt a crippling blow to the South and brought the war to a speedy end. Abe was furious. "Damn it," he cried to Stanton, on learning that McClellan had failed to follow the enemy's retreat. "He has done more to cause me grief than any Confederate." He left for McClellan's camp at Sharpsburg at once. There's a famous photograph of Abraham Lincoln and George B. McClellan sitting across from each other in the general's tent at Sharpsburg. Both look stiff and uncomfortable. History knows that Abe flippantly told McClellan, "If you do not want to use the army, I would very much like to borrow it." What history has never known, however, is what happened shortly before that uncomfortable picture was taken. "Upon greeting McClellan in his tent and shaking the hands of his officers, I ask that we be given a moment alone." Closing the flap of his tent, I placed my hat upon a small table, straightened my coat, and stood before him. "General," I said, "I must ask you a question." "Anything," said he. I grabbed him by the collar and pulled him close, so close that our faces were only inches apart. "May I see them?" "What in God's name are you talking about?" I pulled him closer still. "Your fangs, General. Let me have a look at them." McClellan began to struggle against me, but his feet were no longer touching the ground. "Surely they must be in there," I said, prying his mouth open with one hand. "For how could any living man seek to prolong the agony of war? Come, show me those black eyes. Show me those razors, and let us face each other." I shook him violently. "Show me." I do not understand," he said at last. His confusion was genuine, his fear palpable. I released him, suddenly ashamed that I had allowed my temper to run wild. "No," I said. "No, I can see that you do not." I straightened my coat again and reached for the tent flap. "Come," I said. "Let us give Gardner his photograph and be done with each other." Footnote: Alexander Gardner, the Washington, D.C. photographer who would also take Abe's last portrait. Abe relieved McClellan of his command a month later. After leaving the camp at Sharpsburg, Abe surveyed the aftermath of the battle for himself. The sight of mangled, rigid bodies strewn across Antietam Creek was enough to bring the emotionally weary president to tears. "I wept, for each of these boys was Willie. Each of them left a father cursed as I am cursed, a mother weeping as Mary weeps." Abe sat on the ground beside the corpse of one Union soldier for nearly an hour. He was told that the boy had been struck in the head by cannon fire. "His head was split open at the back, and most of his skull and brains were gone, the result being that his face and scalp lay flat on the ground like an empty bag of grain. The sight of him repulsed me, yet I could not avert my eyes. This boy, this nameless boy, had risen that September morning, unaware that he would never see another. He had dressed and eaten. He had run bravely into battle. And then he had been gone, every moment of his life reduced to a single misfortune. All of his experiences, past and future, emptied onto some strange field far from home. I weep for his mother and father, for his brothers and sisters. But I do not weep for him. For I have come to believe that old saying with all my heart. Only the dead have seen the end of war. 4. As horrible as Antietam was, it was the victory that Abe had been waiting for. On September 22, 1862, he issued the first Emancipation Proclamation, declaring all slaves in rebel states forever free. Reaction was swift. Abolitionists argued that by freeing only the slaves in southern states, Abe hadn't gone far enough. Moderates feared that the measure would only make the South fight with more determination. Some northern soldiers threatened mutiny, arguing that they were fighting to preserve the Union, not Negro freedom. Abe didn't care. The only reaction that concerned him was that of the slaves themselves, and judging by the reports that began trickling in during the last months of 1862, it was precisely the one he'd hoped for. I received today a remarkable account from our allies in New York, related by Seward, of a recent uprising on a plantation near Vicksburg, Mississippi. I am assured that no part of it has been embellished, the account having been conveyed by a runaway Negro boy who witnessed the events firsthand. The happy news of the Emancipation Proclamation having reached their quarters that morning, said Seward, the Negroes rejoiced with spirited songs. Their revels, however, were met with the angry whips of their masters, and a wench collected and chained at the ankles, this being the common manner of taking away those who were never to be seen again. Rather than allow this sorry fate to befall her, as they had allowed it to befall so many before, the Negroes formed a mob and encircled the fattening pen into which she had been taken. When they burst in, carrying sickles and scythes, they were met with a sight which made even the bravest of them cry out in horror. A pair of wild-eyed gentlemen knelt over the shackled wench, each of their blood-stained mouths affixed to one of her naked breasts. She was insensible, most of the color having left her by this time. Composing themselves, several of the Negro men raised their weapons and charged at the devils, thinking them mortals. The vampires, however, moved with such speed as to confound them. They leapt about the pen, clinging to the walls with the ease of insects, as blades swung violently about them. Those who led the charge were slain, their throats opened by pointed claws, their heads struck with such force as to render them dead before they fell. But such were their numbers that the mob was able to overwhelm the gentlemen. Though it took no fewer than 6 men to restrain each of them, the vampires were finally dragged from the fattening pen, held over a watering trough, and beheaded. Word was spreading. The days of America's vampires were numbered. On November 19, 1863, Abe rose before a crowd of 15,000. He pulled a small piece of paper from his pocket, unfolded it, cleared his throat, and began to speak. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He'd come to Gettysburg to dedicate a memorial to the 8,000 men who had given their lives in the 3-day Union victory. As he spoke, Ward Hill Lehman, who can be seen sitting next to Abe in one of the few surviving photos of the event, scanned the crowd anxiously, his hand on the revolver inside his coat, his stomach in knots, for he was the only man protecting the president that day. For 3 hours we sat upon that stage. 3 hours of ceaseless worry, for I was certain that an assassin would strike. Every face seemed to wear an expression of hatred for the president. Every movement seemed prelude to an attempt on his life. At first, Abe had insisted on going to Gettysburg without any guard, worried that the sight of armed men would be inappropriate at an event honoring those who died for their country. Only after Lehman half-jokingly threatened to sabotage the president's train to prevent the trip, did Abe agree to bring him along. "That we here, highly resolved that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government, of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Abe folded the paper and took his seat to moderate applause. He'd spoken for all of 2 minutes. In that short time, he'd given perhaps the greatest speech of the 19th century, one that would be forever ingrained in America's consciousness. And in that short time, Ward Hill Lehman, Abraham Lincoln's most devoted human bodyguard, had reached a decision that would forever alter the course of America's history. The anxiety at Gettysburg had been more than he could bear. As they rode back to Washington, Lehman respectively told the president that he could no longer guard him. 5. On the night of November 8, 1864, Abe walked through driving wind and rain, alone. I resolved to sit in the telegraph office alone and await the returns, just as I had in Springfield 4 long years ago. If I lost, I did not wish to be consoled. If I won, I did not wish to be congratulated. For there were many reasons to welcome the first outcome and mourn the second. The war had claimed nearly 500,000 lives by Election Day. Despite these unimaginable losses, growing war weariness, and deep divides over emancipation in the North, Abe and his new vice president, Democrat Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, won in a landslide against George B. McClellan, the same McClellan Abe had confronted after Antietam. 80% of the Union Army voted to re-elect its commander-in-chief, an astonishing number given the fact that Abe had run against a former Union general, and given the miserable conditions they'd endured for years. On hearing the election results, Union troops outside the Confederate capital of Richmond gave such a cheer that its beleaguered citizens were sure the South had just surrendered. They had reason to expect defeat. Richmond had been surrounded for months. Atlanta, the heart of Southern manufacturing, had been captured. Across the South, emancipated slaves continued to escape to Northern lines by the tens of thousands, crippling Southern agriculture and forcing Confederate vampires to scavenge for easy blood. As a result, the dreaded ghost soldiers who had slaughtered and terrorized Union troops became increasingly scarce. By the time Abe was inaugurated for the second time on March 4, 1865, the war was all but over. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. During the procession that followed his address, a battalion of Negro soldiers joined the others marching past the president's reviewing stand. I was moved to tears as they passed, saluting me, for in each of their faces I saw the face of a nameless victim crying out for justice, of a little girl passing by on the old Cumberland Trail all those many years ago. On each of their faces I saw the anguish of the past and the promise of the future. General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army on April 9, 1865. Effectively ending the Civil War. The following day, Abe received a letter in a familiar scrawl. Abraham, I beg you put enmity aside long enough to read a few words of congratulations. It brings me joy to report that our enemy has begun its exodus, many back to Europe, others to South America and the Orient, where they are less likely to be hunted. They have looked to the future, Abraham, and they have seen that America is now, and shall forever be, a nation of living men. Like your namesake, you have been a father to many these 4 long years. And like your namesake, God has asked impossible sacrifices of you. Yet, you have endured it all as brilliantly as any man could have hoped. You have blessed the futures of those who share this time on earth, and those who have yet to live. She would be proud. Ever. H. As a boy, Abe had vowed to kill every vampire in America. While that had proven impossible, he'd done the next best thing. He'd driven the worst of them out of America. There was one vampire, however, who refused to leave, who believed that the dream of a nation of immortals was still within reach, so long as Abraham Lincoln was dead. His name was John Wilkes Booth. 13. Thus always to tyrants. I leave you, hoping that the lamp of liberty will burn in your bosoms until there shall no longer be a doubt that all men are created free and equal. Abraham Lincoln in a speech at Chicago, Illinois, July 10, 1858. 1. On April 12, 1865, a lone man walked across the White House lawn toward the towering columns of the South Portico, where, on clear spring afternoons such as this, the president himself could often be seen on the third-floor balcony. The man walked briskly, carrying a small leather attaché. The legislation that would create the Secret Service was sitting on Abraham Lincoln's desk that Wednesday evening, and would remain there for the rest of his life. At 3 minutes before 4 o'clock, the man entered the building and gave his name to one of the butlers. "Joshua Speed, to see the president?" A lifetime of war had finally taken its toll on Abe. He'd felt increasingly weak since Willie's death, clouded and unsure. The lines in his face were deeper, and the skin beneath his eyes sagged so as to make him appear forever exhausted. Mary was nearly always depressed, and her rare moments of levity were spent on frenzied fits of decorating and redecorating, or on seances to commune with her beloved Eddie and Willie. She and Abe hardly spoke beyond simple civilities. Sometime between April 3rd and April 5th, during his journey downriver to inspect the fallen city of Richmond, the president scribbled the following poem in the margins of his journal. "Melancholy, my old friend, visits frequent, once again." Desperate for distraction and companionship, Abe invited his old friend and fellow vampire hunter to spend a night at the White House. Upon being notified of Speed's arrival, Abe politely excused himself from a meeting and hurried into the reception room. Speed recalled Abe's entrance in a letter to fellow hunter William Seward after the president's death. "Placing his right hand upon my shoulder, the president paused momentarily as our faces met. I dare say he found mine surprised and saddened, for when I studied him, I saw frailty that I had never encountered before. Gone was the broad-shouldered giant who could drive an axe clean through a vampire's middle. Gone were the smiling eyes and confident air. In their place was a hunched, gaunt gentleman whose skin had taken on a sickly pallor, and whose features belonged to a man 20 years his senior. My dear Speed, he said, and took me into his arms. The two hunters dined alone, Mary having confined herself to bed with a headache. After dinner, they retired to Abe's office, where they remained well into the early morning hours, laughing and reminiscing as if they were above the store in Springfield again. They spoke of their hunting days, of the war, of the rumors that vampires were fleeing America in droves. But most of all, they talked of nothing, their families, their businesses, the miracle of photography. It was precisely as I had hoped. My troubles were distant, my thoughts quieted, and I felt something like my old self again, if only for those ephemeral hours. Sometime well after midnight, after Abe had kept his friend laughing with his bottomless well of anecdotes, he told him about a dream that had been troubling him for days. In one of his final journal entries, Lincoln recorded it for posterity. "There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me. Then I heard subdued sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. I left my bed and wandered downstairs. There the silence was broken by the same pitiful sobbing, but the mourners were invisible. I went from room to room, No living person was in sight, but the same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. I was puzzled and alarmed. What could be the meaning of all this? I kept on until I arrived at the east room, which I entered. There, I met with a sickening surprise. Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers who were acting as guards, and there was a throng of people, gazing mournfully upon the corpse, whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. "Who is dead in the White House?" I demanded of one of the soldiers. "The president," was his answer. "He was killed by an assassin." Then came a loud burst of grief from the crowd, which woke me from my dream. I slept no more that night. 2. John Wilkes Booth loathed sunlight. It irritated his skin, overwhelmed his eyes. It made the fat pink faces of boastful Northerners blinding as they passed him on the street, crowing about Union victories, celebrating the end of the rebellion. "You have no idea what this war is about." The 26-year-old had always preferred the darkness, even before he became its servant. His home had always been the stage, its braided ropes and velvet curtains, its warm gaslight glow. Theater had been the center of his life, and it was a theater he entered just before noon to collect his mail. There would no doubt be letters from admiring fans, perhaps someone who had witnessed his legendary Mark Antony in New York, or thrilled to his more recent Pescara in The Apostate, performed on the very boards now beneath his boots. The backstage loading door had been opened to allow daylight in, as had the exits in the rear of the house, but Ford's theater remained mostly dark. The first and second balconies were draped in shadow, and every time Booth's heel landed on the stage, the resulting echoes filled the emptiness. There was no place more pleasing, more natural to him, than this. Booth would often pass the daylight hours in darkened theaters, sleeping on a catwalk, reading in an upper balcony by candlelight, or rehearsing for an audience of ghosts. "An empty theater is a promise." Isn't that what they said? "An empty theater is a promise unfulfilled." In a few hours, everything around him would be light and noise, laughter and applause. Colorful people packed together in their colorful finery. Tonight, the promise would be fulfilled. And then, after the curtain came down and the gas lights were snuffed out, there would be darkness again. That was the beauty of it. That was theater. Booth noticed a pair of men working in the stage left boxes, about 10 feet above his head. They were removing the partition between two smaller boxes in order to make a single large one, no doubt for a person of some import. He recognized one of the stagehands as Edmund Spangler, a calloused, red-faced old acquaintance and frequent employee.
"And who are to be your honored guests, Spangler?" Booth asked.
"The President and First Lady, sir, accompanied by General and Mrs. Grant."
Booth hurried out of the theater without another word. He never collected his mail. There were friends to be contacted, plans to be drawn up, weapons to be readied, and so little time to do it all. So little time, but such an opportunity. He made straight for Mary Surratt's boarding house. Mary, a plain, plump, dark-haired widow, was Booth's former lover and an ardent Southern sympathizer. She'd met him years before, when he'd been a guest at her family's tavern in Maryland. Though 14 years his senior, she'd fallen passionately in love with the young actor, and the two had carried on an affair. After her husband died, Mary sold the tavern and moved to Washington, where she opened a small boarding house on H Street. Booth was a frequent guest, but in recent years, he'd seemed less interested in matters of the flesh. Mary's feelings for him, however, remained unchanged. So when Booth asked her to ride out to the old tavern and tell its current owner, John Lloyd, to make ready the shooting irons, she didn't hesitate. Booth had left a cache of weapons with Lloyd weeks before, in preparation for a failed plot to kidnap Lincoln and exchange him for Confederate prisoners. Now he would use the same weapons to take a more direct approach. Mary's love for Booth would prove her undoing. For delivering his message, she would hang 3 months later. While Mary was on her fatal errand, Booth visited the homes of Lewis Powell and George Atzerodt in quick succession. Both had been involved in his failed kidnapping plot, and both would be needed to carry out the audacious plan that was still taking shape in his head. Atzerodt, an older, rough-looking German immigrant and carriage repairman, was an old acquaintance of Booth's. The boyishly handsome Powell, not yet 22 years old, was a former rebel soldier, member of the Confederate Secret Service, and friend of the Surratts. A meeting was arranged for 7 that evening. Booth gave no reason for it. He merely told the men to be on time and to bring their nerve. 3. Abe was in fine spirits. "Laughter shook his door all morning," wrote Nicolay years later. "At first I mistook the sound for something else, so accustomed had I grown to the president's cheerlessness." Hugh McCulloch, Treasury Secretary, remembered, "I never saw Mr. Lincoln so merry." Abe had been buoyed by the reunion with his hunters and by the telegrams flying out of the War Office on an almost hourly basis. Lee had surrendered to Ulysses Grant 5 days earlier at the Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, effectively bringing the war to a close. Jefferson Davis and his government were on the run. In order to personally congratulate Ulysses Grant on his brilliant defeat of Robert E. Lee, the Lincolns had invited him and his wife to the theater that evening. There was a new comedy at Ford's, and a few hours of carefree laughter was exactly what the president and Mrs. Lincoln needed. However, the general had respectfully declined, as he and Julia were to leave Washington by train that evening. This set off a flurry of replacement invitations, all of which were promptly and respectfully declined for one reason or another. "One would think that we were inviting them to an execution," Mary is reported to have remarked during the course of the day. It mattered little to Abe. No amount of rejection, respectful or otherwise, could sully his mood that warm Good Friday afternoon. "I am strangely buoyant," Speaker of the House Schuyler Colfax called this morning to discuss Reconstruction, and upon observing me for a quarter hour, paused and asked if I had eschewed my coffee for a scotch. Such was my disposition. Neither the cabinet nor Vice President Andrew Johnson were successful in their efforts to dampen my spirits today, though both tried mightily to do so. However, I dare not speak of this happiness aloud, for Mary would surely see such boastfulness as a bad omen. It has long been her nature, and mine, to distrust these moments of quiet as prelude to some unforeseen disaster. And yet the trees bloom beautifully today, and I cannot help but take note. The journal entry was dated April 14, 1865. It was the last Abe would ever make. By late afternoon, with the day's official business done, the president prepared to take a late afternoon carriage ride with his wife. Though not as jovial as her husband, Mary also seemed to be in unusually good spirits, and she'd asked Abe to join her for a brief turn about the yard. As the president stepped out of the north portico, a one-armed Union soldier, who'd been waiting there most of the day in hopes of such an encounter, shouted, "I would almost give my other hand if I could shake that of Abraham Lincoln." Abe approached the young man and extended his hand. "You shall do that, and it shall cost you nothing." 4. Booth arrived in Lewis Powell's rented room at 7 o'clock sharp, accompanied by a short, nervous 22-year-old pharmacist named David Harold, whom he'd met through Mary Surratt. Atzerodt was already there. Booth wasted no time. In a few hours, the four of them would bring the Union to its knees. At precisely 10 o'clock, Lewis Powell was to kill Secretary of State William Seward, who was currently bedridden after falling from a carriage. Powell, who was unfamiliar with Washington, would be led to Seward's house by the nervous pharmacist. After the secretary was dead, the two conspirators would ride across the Navy Yard Bridge and into Maryland, where they would meet up with Booth. At the same time, Atzerodt was to shoot Vice President Andrew Johnson in his room at the Kirkwood House before joining the others in Maryland. As for Booth, he would return to Ford's Theater. There, he would kill the president with a single-shot Derringer pistol before plunging a knife into General Grant's heart. With the Union government decapitated, Jefferson Davis and his cabinet would have time to reorganize. Confederate generals like Joseph E. Johnston, Meriwether Thompson, and Stand Watty, whose armies were fighting valiantly against the Yankee Devils even now, would be able to rearm. From Maryland, Booth and his three companions would continue south, relying on the kindness of their fellow sympathizers for food and shelter, while the Union pursued them. As news of their deeds spread, a chorus of joyful voices would ring from Texas to the Carolinas. The tide would turn, they would all be hailed as heroes, and John Wilkes Booth would be called the Savior of the South. Atzerodt protested, insisting that he'd agreed to a kidnapping, not a murder. Booth launched into a stirring speech. There is no record of what he said, only that it was soaring and thoroughly convincing. Probably it contained references to Shakespeare. Certainly it had been rehearsed for this very occasion. Whatever Booth's words, they worked. Atzerodt reluctantly agreed to go forward. But what the apprehensive German didn't know, what none of the living conspirators would ever know, even as they climbed the 13 steps to their deaths, was the truth behind the young actor's hatred of Lincoln. On the surface, it made no sense. John Wilkes Booth had been called the handsomest man in America. Audiences packed theaters all over the country to watch him perform. Women trampled one another to catch a glimpse of him. He'd been born into the nation's preeminent acting family and made his professional debut as a teenager. Unlike his famous older brothers, Edwin and Junius, who were actors in the classic sense, John was raw and instinctive, leaping about the stage, screaming at the top of his lungs. Every word, no matter how innocuous, seemed spoken in anger, wrote a reviewer for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. And yet one cannot help but be captivated by it. There is an almost ethereal quality to the gentleman. One night, following a performance of Macbeth at the Richmond Theater, Booth reportedly took six young ladies back to his boarding house and wasn't seen for 3 days. He was rich. He was adored. He was doing what he loved. John Wilkes Booth should have been the happiest man alive. But he wasn't alive. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hours upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Footnote: Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 5. When he was 13 years old, Johnny Booth paid an old gypsy woman to read his palm. He'd always been obsessed with fate, particularly his own, due in large part to a story often told by his eccentric mother. "On the night you were born," she'd say, "I asked God for a sign of what awaited my newborn son, and God saw fit to answer." For the rest of her life, Marianne Booth would swear that flames had suddenly leapt from the hearth of their fireplace and formed the word country. Johnny spent countless hours pondering the meaning of it. He knew that something special awaited him. He could feel it. "Oh, a bad hand," the gypsy said at once, recoiling slightly. Sorrow and trouble wherever I look." Booth had come expecting a glimpse of his future greatness. What he got were forecasts of doom. "You'll die young," said the gypsy, "but not before amassing a thundering crowd of enemies." Booth protested. She was wrong. She had to be wrong. The gypsy shook her head. Nothing could prevent it. John Wilkes Booth would make a bad end. 7 years later, the first part of her grim fortune came true. Of the 6 young women Booth took back to his Richmond boarding house that night, only one remained by morning. He'd sent the others scurrying out the door before sunrise, their hair a mess, clothing bundled in their arms. After the fog of whiskey had lifted, he'd found them to be nothing more than the same silly, chatty, opportunistic girls who greeted him at every stage door in every city. He had no use for them beyond what had already transpired. The girl in bed with him, however, was something entirely different. She was a small, dark-haired, ivory-skinned beauty of 20 or so, but carried herself with the calm confidence of a much older woman. There was a slyness to her, and though she seldom spoke, when she did, it was with humor and wisdom. They made love for hours at a time. No woman, not Mary Surratt or his countless stage door conquests, had ever made Booth feel like this. He was drawn to her in a way he'd only been drawn to the theater. "Every woman before her has been a promise unfulfilled." In moments of rest, Booth filled the silences with stories of his youth, the word country in the fire, the gypsy, the inescapable feeling that he was destined for greatness, something more than fame or money could provide. The ivory-skinned girl placed her lips against his ear and told him of a way that he could achieve that greatness. Perhaps he believed her. Perhaps he was merely humoring his young lover. But at some point during that second night, John Wilkes Booth willingly drank her blood. For the next 2 days, he suffered through the worst and last sickness of his life. He drenched his sheets in sweat, suffered horrific visions, convulsed so violently that the legs of his bed clattered against the floor. 3 days after he'd last been seen in public, Booth awoke. He rose and stood in the center of the room, alone. The ivory-skinned girl was gone. He would never learn her name, never see her again. He didn't care. He'd never felt more alive than he did at this moment, never seen or heard with such clarity. She spoke the truth. Booth had craved immortality since he was a child. Now it was his. He'd always known that some special fate awaited him. Here it was. He would be the greatest actor of his generation, of every generation. His name would be renowned in ways that Edwin and Junius could only imagine. He would grace the theaters of the world, watch empires crumble to dust, commit every word of Shakespeare to memory. He was the master of time and space. Booth couldn't help but smile as another thought crossed his mind. The old gypsy was right. He died young, just as she said he would. And now he would live forever. "I am a vampire," he thought. "God be praised."